Could the technology behind satellite laser communications help investors make smarter decisions by determining the number of cars parked in Walmart lots? Should humanity colonize Venus instead of Elon Musk's vision of moving to Mars? Science fiction scenarios? Business opportunities? Maybe both. On the surface, science fiction and business or political decision-making may seem like an odd couple, but President Ronald Reagan famously received weekly science fiction briefings when he was in office. Business and government agencies have hired science fiction writers to give them what-if advice. Now come into all of this is Scout. Scout is a website and community that looks at near-term implications of technology through the lens of science fiction to help organizations make decisions with less risk. Welcome to GeekWire from GeekWire.com in Seattle. I'm Frank Catalano, GeekWire contributor and host of this special interview series with some of the leading voices of the science fiction, popular culture, and the arts communities. I'm pleased to be joined by Barrett Anderson. Barrett is CEO and editor-in-chief of Scout, on the web at scout.ai. Barrett's a former managing editor of the Seattle news site crosscut.com and continues to work with the predictive technology newsletter Strategic News Service. Barrett, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So let's go back to the beginning. How did Scout get its start?
Well, I started Scout with my co-founder a few years ago, about 3 years ago, and the whole idea behind it, I really grew up working with my family to run a tech conference that you mentioned. It's called Future in Review, and every year we would bring together top tech execs, scientists, science fiction authors, documentary filmmakers to talk about the future of technology. Where is tech going in the next 5 to 10 years? And how can we use it to solve problems in medicine, education, climate, all across the board? And so working with that group of people over such a long time, people like, you know, Elon Musk and Vint Cerf and Vinod Khosla, I really saw how strategic foresight and science fiction impacted and shaped their worldview. And not just, you know, how they think about the future, but also a lot of science fiction creates kind of a blueprint for some of the world's top technologists and CEOs. The iPhone, for example, first existed on Star Trek, right? And so it kind of creates this mental model, this mental blueprint that allows people to build towards the things, to really build the technologies that exist in science fiction. So seeing how closely this was being used by this very high level group of technologists, I wanted to bring that kind of foresight and strategic thinking to a broader community in the tech world.
And why do it in a way like Scout? I mean, obviously people have been inspired by science fiction for many years. Why is Scout different? What's its unique take?
So I think the thing that we do differently, we focus on bringing really two clear things that others don't. One is strategic imagination, which is we're bringing this power of imagination to the tech world in a way that is not just about it. You know, I think a lot of people hear the term imagination and they think of it as something for children. And so what we're trying to do is to use our imagination and to help our members and our readers understand how to use your imagination as a strategic tool. Because the thing that the tech industry most often misses is not just how technology will affect the world, but how the world will respond to technology. That often can make or break a specific product.
What's your forecasting time frame on Scout? How far out do you try to, I wouldn't say predict, but provide what-if scenarios for?
So we're generally looking at anywhere between 2 to 7 years out in the future. And the idea behind this is, as humans, we're really bad at predicting anything more than 10 years ahead of time. And so a lot of what we do is we bring together existing trends in not just tech, but economics. We look at how specific leaders of major countries or companies are behaving and why. And then we create this entire kind of worldview that helps us understand how technology is being deployed and how it will affect society more clearly than other people.
Now, Scout kind of officially launched in 2016. I know you've been working on it for longer than that, with a Kickstarter campaign that was pretty successful, wasn't it?
Yeah. So we raised $40,000, I believe, if I'm remembering correctly. That could be wrong, to start Scout originally. And the goal of that was actually partially about raising money so that we could get the thing off the ground, but mostly about trying to see, is there a community of people that actually want this? Because at that time, you know, people were still very dubious about self-driving cars. We would go around and tell people, well, you know, self-driving cars are going to be here faster than you think. And they'd be like, no, they're probably 10 years off. And now we have, you know, mostly autonomous vehicles that are on the road today. They're just not legal yet.
So Kickstarter was kind of a proof of concept to see what kind of an uptake
exactly
there would be. And you raised your amount, if I recall, in about a week?
Yep. Yeah.
So how would you describe the kind of science fiction that you post? As you mentioned, people think of science fiction, they hear imagination, but science fiction is such a broad genre with all sorts of sub-genres. I mean, we're not talking Star Wars here, are we?
So we actually have a really interesting editorial approach where we combine – so we combine analysis and near-term science fiction in every issue that we look at. So what we'll do is we have a science fiction editor based in Oakland, Elliot Pepper, who's actually a science fiction author himself. He's a brilliant guy, very strategic mind. He's worked in the tech space and in the venture space as well. And he and I will have an editorial meeting where we figure out the next issue, right, the next episode. And the focus of that, and then we start brainstorming, right? We just, it's kind of like this combined analysis and science fiction brainstorm where we think about all of the possible futures of that specific technology and like what are all of the possible implications of the specific technology. And then we work with freelance writers and editors to, you know, go out and write a real piece of analysis and investigative reporting on that. And then also the science fiction authors, right? So they're working on, we come up with some ideas like possible science fiction stories or angles that would be interesting to explore. And then we meet with them and they often have ideas. And so we kind of have an interchange of ideas.
And how often do you do this?
So it's a monthly feature.
Roughly?
Yeah.
Roughly.
Yeah.
And what is, do you have some favorite topics from recently? I mean, I mentioned a couple about colonizing Venus instead of Mars, about using the technology that satellites once tested to communicate with each other to basically allow it to do real-time stuff with the Earth. Do you have any favorites?
So I mean, I think the nearer satellites is super interesting. So with our most recent space issue, we did a dual thing, right? The analysis piece focused on near Earth satellites, and then the fiction piece focused on colonizing Venus, as you mentioned. But the analysis around near Earth satellites is fascinating because it's this industry that is just starting to take off, but really hasn't gotten that much attention because there are other parts of space that are sexier, right? So like, mining asteroids is really interesting and exciting. Like sending a colony to Mars is really interesting and exciting. Near Earth satellites are kind of like, meh, when you hear about them. But they have these really fascinating implications for what life will be like here on Earth in the future.
So like what? Well, what we might not think of if we're just hearing about it now?
There are two angles or recent developments that have made this possible. But one is, we used to rely on radio communication in order to send information, videos, internet back and forth between satellites and back and forth to Earth. And recently we started using laser communication. And what that means is that we can suddenly transmit video, real-time video, not real-time, but live video much more quickly than we used to be able to. And that combines with this new, there's been a sudden, because satellites are much smaller now, they used to be about the size, you know, they used to be very big. Now some of them are the size of a bread box, essentially. And so that means that it's become a lot cheaper to send satellites up to space.
So we have that ability to do essentially close to real-time communication with the satellites with Earth and much more bandwidth. So you can push a bunch of stuff through that pipe a lot faster. And what were some of the implications then that that your analysis came up with and that might have fictional implications too?
Well, I think one of the things that's really interesting are the surveillance implications, right? So there's kind of like the Big Brother implications, and then there are the optimism implications. Clearly, if you have a million satellites around Earth creating real-time live video feeds, that is both terrifying, depending on who has access to those feeds and how they're using them, right? So like if you say, for example, you had an online stalker and they were able to hack into that video feed and see where you were at any point in time, that would be pretty scary. Say there were advertising companies that were then able to access those video feeds to see exactly where you were and send you even more messages, or to analyze your facial expressions, for example, while you were walking down the street to see how you reacted to specific businesses that you were passing. Those are all kind of Big Brother side surveillance. But on the other hand, there are also very positive implications of this. So, for example, climate tracking. So tracking of ice flow or melt or seawater rise. These are all things that we've never really been able to measure in real time. We've relied on sensors that we have to go back in and kind of check over and over and over again. And so if we can suddenly see in real time how these kinds of like water flow and scarcity and animal migration, it creates like a very powerful feedback loop that could help us actually deal with that in a much more interesting way.
All right. I'm talking with Barrett Anderson, CEO and editor-in-chief of Scout. You can check out a number of these things that are posted out in the open at scout.ai. You're listening to GeekWire, and we'll be right back after a break. Welcome back. We're talking with Barrett Anderson, the CEO and editor-in-chief of Scout, which at scout.ai takes a look at analysis of near-term technologies and also puts them into a science fictional context so you can get a better idea of how they might really work in the real world, in the near future, that is. Barrett, a question about the history of this type of thing. Early on, I mentioned that President Reagan used to get briefings on science fiction. Now, that might strike some people as very odd, but has this type of thing then had a long history, even in a more formal way than just people reading science fiction?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. So one of our advisors, Greg Baer, was a part of a group that used to give Ronald Reagan weekly science fiction briefings when he was in office. And his policy team got 30 to 40 page weekly science fiction briefings. So this has been going on for a long time, right? As long as science fiction has been around. Interestingly enough, Greg told me that conservative governments are actually more likely to rely on science fiction authors to help them plan for the future and to work with them as advisors than Democratic presidents and administrations. But regardless, I mean, one of the interesting things about, for example, the intelligence community and the military is that they really kind of stay steady throughout, regardless of the political party of the president. So the FBI and the CIA, the military have been working with science fiction authors and strategic foresight experts for years to help them figure out where is the world headed and what are the kind of big problems coming up in the future that we need to be ready for and we need to be prepared for.
Funny you should mention that, because when I knew we were going to be having this conversation, I vaguely recalled something I was involved in the mid-1980s, back in 1985, which was, of course, during President Reagan's administration. And I, when I used to write science fiction, was invited with a number of other science fiction writers by the U.S. Army's Joint Services Small Arms Program Office to take part in this thing in Seattle at Battelle called the Future Small Arms Concept Workshop. What we were supposed to do was all get together in a room for a couple of days and brainstorm, as science fiction writers, the future of small arms.
You know, I actually did that again this last summer with a group, the U.S. military in D.C. So it was a gathering of the Army War College and top technologists and strategic foresight experts from around the country. And we got together for 2 days to talk about the future of information warfare and where that's headed. And what we ended with was a collection of about 35 different science fiction stories that we came up with over the course of the weekend that were intended to model out specific possible threats from international actors.
Well, I have
by way of information warfare. So it's a tradition that's still going on today.
Yeah, and this was back, of course, in the 80s. And the writers then, of course, were David Brin, who's a science fiction writer, was involved. Fred Pohl was a science fiction Dean Ng out of Oregon. And I kept my notes. They tried to classify it after the fact at the end of the session, and all of us refused. And I'm just going to drop that down there so you can hear what an inch and a half of paper notes sounds like. But what was interesting about this, and what made me want to bring it up, is not only has this been going on a long time, as you pointed out on scout.ai, but sometimes it goes in directions you don't expect. When all the writers got together in the room at the Battelle Labs, we basically said, we're happy to help you brainstorm this. It must be non-lethal. We will only help you brainstorm non-lethal small arms. Yet it was interesting how quickly we devolved into talking about new and more lethal ways to come up with concepts. So that makes me wonder, has anything surprised you in the stuff you've put into Scout that you just went in a direction you just flat out did not expect?
Well, so specifically, yeah, absolutely. We had this really interesting string of events where science fiction became reality. So when we launched, we put together a series of infographics about the future of technology that were like fake news reports from the future. And one of them was, this was in 2014 or 15. One of them was about Facebook employees skewing the newsfeed to make Hillary Clinton president by changing small parts of the algorithm in key swing states. And so this was way ahead of anything happening in the US, right? But we put this out. We were like, haha, wouldn't it be funny if this happened? Fast forward, you know, a year, and the Facebook featured stories, trending stories debate started happening, where all of these conservatives were accusing Facebook of being biased against conservatives in its trending stories feature, which is three little lines on the side of your newsfeed if you're a Facebook user. And so at that point, we came out and said, hey, you guys are literally missing the main event here. There's trending stories takes up this teeny tiny bit of space on Facebook, and likewise a relatively pretty teeny tiny amount of mind share of Facebook users, right? But the news feed is like very central. It's, you're kind of consuming it in this very addictive manner, which has been designed to be addictive. And we were like, this is a huge risk for democracy. So we wrote this big story in 20, as Donald Trump was taking the stage, we posted it, as he was taking the stage for his Republican nomination. But it was all about, we talked to all these sources inside of Google and Facebook, and we determined that two engineers working together could make a substantive change to the newsfeed that could affect the outcome of an election or change the outcome of an election without anyone else at the company knowing about it.
And a lot of the stuff you did here, as you said, was long before people saw changes to the Facebook
exactly.
newsfeed, and you were doing kind of like, hey, wouldn't this be unusual
yes,
if someone
yes.
were to pull this off, and suddenly it happens. So how do you choose topics for Scout? I mean, do you have a whole bunch of ideas, a backlog of topics that you're waiting for them to be timely, or what's your process?
So, I mean, I think a lot of it is just about what seems most important at the time. So we have three kind of key problems that we're interested in solving, and we bring a lot of focus on those to our editorial process. One is that climate change is an existential threat to humanity. Two, AI and automation will at some point demand a renegotiation of the social safety net. We're open to what that looks like, but we believe that there will be a need to change our relationship to work in some way, whatever that looks like. And then the third is that democracy is broken and in need of an upgrade. It's just not functioning the way it was designed to, and it's really become corrupted through a lot of different economic and political factors. So those are the core, like, those are our core beliefs as a company, and those are the core problems that we're interested in solving. And they often drive a lot of, when we think about new technologies, we think a lot about how do these things contribute to those three problems. And we also use those to think about, you know, our subscribers, right? Because we're interested in bringing together people who want to try to solve those problems, and those and other problems. But those are what we think are the most pressing to humanity at the moment. And so we don't care what your background is. We don't care what your political beliefs are. We're not interested in you know, aligning necessarily with one side or the other. It's like, we have these three problems. If you also agree with these problems and you have ideas or ways to think about solving them, then, like, come on in, because we're all on the same team.
So those three just sort of general areas, then, you look at technology and its impact on these?
So specifically those three.
Specifically those three areas. Now, here's a good point to bring up, too, that, you know, if somebody goes to scout.ai, they're going to see essentially a non-subscriber view of what's available. And you have an invitation-only community at
mm-hmm.
this point. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you can request an invitation, and then we kind of review and approve invitations as they come in.
How do you make money at your organization?
Through subscriptions.
Okay.
Yeah. So we have a subscription is $12 a month. And so our membership base has access to all of our content, all of our stories. We have these monthly features. I also send out 3 times a week emails to members kind of with my thoughts. So it's pretty similar to Stratechery, if you're familiar with that, Ben Thompson's subscription site. So we also have events for our members where we put on these scenario planning games in different cities around the country. We have a lot of members in San Francisco, for example. We just did an event there, scenario planning the 2020 election.
Are any of the subscribers from companies we may have heard from? I feel like I should ask that.
Absolutely, yeah. No, so we have subscribers from all across major tech companies. For example, we put out, just to give you kind of an idea of the type of readership that we have, we put out in last February the first piece that explained how Cambridge Analytica and the Trump campaign and Russia were using tech platforms to change the outcome of the election. And so this was long before any of the reporting was done in the mainstream media. BuzzFeed wrote 3 pieces or 2 pieces at the time calling us conspiracy theorists. Everything that we wrote then about search optimization being hacked, cookies being used to retarget voters based on their interests and their personalities, Facebook dark ads being used, A/B tests being done through Facebook and to the tune of 100,000 at times a day. And then these armies of bots spreading misinformation on Twitter and Facebook is now common knowledge, right? But at the time, it was very provocative, and there were quite a few people who thought it was a conspiracy theory. the other interesting thing is Pierre Omidyar tweeted about it immediately and said, you know, this might sound like a conspiracy theory, but it's actually just marketing applied to politics for the first time.
And who is that person?
Pierre Omidyar is the founder of eBay.
Okay, so he has a little bit of credibility.
He has a little bit of sway. So it's great to have that kind of, you know, those kinds of smart people backing up the work that you're doing. In addition, we know that that same piece was circulated internally to at Google by Eric Schmidt. We know that Tim Berners-Lee linked to it in his post on the 25th anniversary of the internet. He was the creator of the World Wide Web, and he included it as one of the top three problems facing the internet in the next 25 years. So.
Does it ever bother you to be right on some of these issues, especially the ones that people say are kind of paranoid or conspiracy theory, and you're going, no, we've got the analysis here. Does it ever bother you that you're right?
Does it bother me to be right? No. I think it's the important thing when you're working on things like that is being okay when other people think that you're wrong, right? So I don't get upset if people criticize my work. Because we bring a lot of thought and foresight to it, right? And I think the most important thing, the thing that media and thought leaders generally most often get wrong is not knowing when to admit, if they are wrong, right? So if I've written something where it's not backed up correctly, right? Which I try very hard not to do, but I would come out in a very straightforward way and say, okay, yeah, you're right. I should have had, you know, or I thought the source could be trusted and they couldn't. And I apologize for misleading people. But I mean, so far that hasn't happened. But I would absolutely do that. And I think it's important on the other side of that to know, you know, I tell this to a lot of young journalists that I work with as well. It's like, if you're doing your job correctly, people will criticize you and you will make a lot of people angry. Because that's just the nature of the truth. It's often inconvenient for economic and political and personal, for people's name, right? So it can often make people look bad.
Their reputation,
yeah,
or their saving face,
yeah,
if you will.
Exactly.
Well, and of course, that's the beauty of being able to hide behind just science fiction for entertainment, which of course is not what you do. You use science fiction for analysis, but hiding behind science fiction for entertainment is, I was wrong. So what? It was a great story.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, and it also allows us to speculate about things that may or may not happen, which is a very useful tool. So a lot of journalists, I mean, that was a big part of why we decided to combine science fiction with reporting to begin with, is because it gives as journalists, but also as thinkers, it gives us the ability to speculate and to think about multiple possible futures and all of the different parameters around that, which is a pretty powerful tool.
All right. I'm talking with Barrett Anderson, CEO and editor-in-chief of Scout. You're listening to GeekWire, and we'll be right back after a break. We're back with Barrett Anderson, the CEO and editor-in-chief of Scout at scout.ai. Barrett, I'm curious. You started this whole concept 3 years ago, as you mentioned, and things change over time. Has your thoughts on the purpose of Scout evolved over time as well, or are you still pretty true to what you originally thought it was going to be?
I think, if anything, the purpose of Scout as an organization has become more needed and more acute, in that we started to bring more foresight and strategic analysis to the tech community generally. And if anything, what we've seen in the last 2 years is there's just been this huge sea change of people suddenly realizing, both on the policy side and the tech side, that A, yes, technology is extremely important. B, we do need to understand it. Or else, C, bad things happen. Like, we've seen it in this Facebook debate with Facebook testifying before Congress and Twitter testifying before Congress. But it's really interesting to watch, the tech community itself also start to reckon with some of, you know, they've been working really, really hard to build these incredible tools for the last 5 years without necessarily, I think, realizing the impact that they might have and how they might be used out of turn by nefarious actors. And so it's very interesting to see those kinds of conversations actually coming much more to the fore now.
That actually makes me wonder too, because tech community members tend to be big science fiction fans, right? So is using science fiction as a communications tool or a scenario tool a way to speak to the tech community in its own language?
I think so. I mean, in addition to being a way to speak to the tech community in its own language, story in general, right? Fictional story in general is a way to have conversations about topics that could be considered controversial, where you can actually get people to think about things without bringing all of their kind of own personal baggage.
Sort of like Star Trek originally did.
Easier to think about a problem in a fictional space if you're not caught up in your own personal politics and your own personal beliefs and how that might threaten those systems. And so it actually allows us to have what we've found is that, especially in the events that we throw, it allows us to have much more interesting conversations because people are not necessarily coming as a representative of X, right? We give them permission to be a character in a science fiction scenario, and they're able to come up with some really interesting solutions for integrating some of these technologies into society better.
And my apologies for stepping on you a little bit earlier there, but I was just thinking back to Star Trek because one of the original Star Trek series, part of its proposition and made it appealing was it could talk about Earth without being set on Earth. It could talk about moral issues and all sorts of things like that, but it was a safe space, right? Because it was set in a fictional non-Earth world.
Absolutely. Yeah. Star Trek had, I think, one of the first black female leads as a show. And that, for that, it was very, I mean, it was very focused on these social justice issues that were not top of mind. They just kind of did them.
Yeah, not to nerd out here with you, but there was the first interracial kiss.
Yep.
Was in Star Trek. They dealt with issues of genocide. They dealt with issues of racism. They dealt with all sorts of issues without having to say those words.
Exactly.
And that made it interesting. So in some respects, being able to do scenarios where people don't feel threatened by a fictional scenario, whereas if you basically put it out as straightforward analysis, they might, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
So you've also an interesting section, the community section that's members only, and you post provocative questions in that section. Do you have a favorite provocative question or an unusual response to one that really made you think that stands out? I just think about one or two things. I'll just mention one that was already on there, which, and we talked a bit about this in an earlier part of this interview, but you're given early access to a real-time satellite feed of Earth's surface that allows you to make out individual facial expressions. That, of course, is something you and I have already here talked about. But the question you pose is, how do you take advantage of your first mover advantage to generate economic returns? What kind of responses did you get?
Let's see. So I would probably have to go back and look at them to remember the exact responses. But I mean, there are a lot of things that you can do one of the more interesting responses to that question, I think, was the idea that you could create a hedge fund that takes advantage of, invests short term in specific futures that it can tell are going to either come true or not come true, right? So you could short water supply in a specific country. You could look for kind of geographical signs that they were depleting their aquifers. And then take the profits from that and actually reinvest them back into climate science. So it's a pretty interesting kind of, way to think about, okay, so like, how can we make, there are a lot of people that are making money off of these changes in climate, through the same process, right? There are a lot of large companies out there who've invested in agricultural infrastructure for that same purpose, right? So they can have a sense, they have early data about whether or not, you know, where droughts are happening, where there's going to be a shortage of wheat, for example, or where there's going to be a shortage of some other commodity. And then they can actually make money by shorting those resources. And so what if you took that same model, but instead used it to actually help try to fight those exact same problems that are causing that to begin with?
Part of me, of course, when you talked about that, and using somebody else's misery to make money had me in a moral quandary. And obviously, I would assume in your science fiction stories that are tied to these things, the moral issues come to the fore. But do they also come to the fore in the community where people say, yeah, you could do that, but should you?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think the kinds of subscribers and members that Scout attracts are, I mean, and that question, I wrote that question. I posed it in a provocative manner on purpose because I know that our members are generally benevolent humans, right? They're good people. I've met many of them and they're freaking awesome. But the thing that I think people who consider themselves to be more mindful or more cognizant don't realize is that they realize, but often I think limits people who are trying to do good from having an impact in the world is they're not willing to think like those who are purely driven by economics. And if you're not willing to think like those who are purely driven by economics, there's no way you're going to be able to compete with them, because they're not considering, you know, the social aspects. They're not considering the environmental aspects. And so you really have to be able to think like the people who are driving these kinds of trends in order to think about, okay, well, how do we take that same mentality and either work around it or curb it or stop it or actually just use it to our advantage? Because at least, you know, like maybe we could outcompete them and then put that to use for good.
Do you highlight some of those differences in thought approach in the fictional pieces that you have?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I think so. One of the things that our science fiction editor, Elliot Pepper, does very well. He wrote a book. He actually has a new book out called Bandwidth that's all about the information warfare aspect. But one of the things that he does very well in his writing is to portray the complexities of these big companies and big institutions and their externalities. Because I think there's this view generally in society that it's like people are either good or bad, right? And the reality is much more complicated than that. It's like people are driven by a set of economic, political, personal motivations and boundaries, right? And so within those things, they can do things that they believe are good for the world or they believe are good for a specific thing that can have a lot of adverse negative effects. And the thing that I love about Elliot's writing is that he does a very good job of portraying that, right? So he has this one, there's a major tech company in one of his books that's very surveillance focused and, you know, collects tons of data about everyone. But it started by this woman who actually has very good intentions. And so a lot of it is about kind of how she battles with where her company started versus where it has come and how the market has shaped that path. And that's something that I think, you know, the founders of Google, for example, right? Elon Musk founding the first electric car company. These are real things that executives are dealing with and struggling with.
Since you mentioned Elon Musk, I don't want to end this interview without talking about Venus versus Mars for colonization, because we talked about that. I mentioned that at the very beginning. I'm first curious about how this topic even came up and then why Venus? I mean, how did that thought process evolve?
Mm-hmm. So I have been curious about why Mars for quite a long time, right? So Mars itself has become this object of fascination for the space community. It's like, well, we just need to get to Mars and make a colony, and then everything's going to be okay, right? Like, we don't have to really worry about things here on Earth because we're just going to colonize Mars and it'll be fine. And like, the smart ones of us will go up to Mars and we'll just all be cool. We'll hang out together. But the reality of life on Mars is not going to be very fun, right? We're not going to have the same, like, it's going to take a long time to establish a colony that creates any kind of habitable circumstances on Mars. You're going to be trapped there with the same small, tiny group of people, many of whom you may or may not like. You're not going to have, you know, your Teslas and, I mean, you might have Tesla because you are on Mars.
You actually might have Teslas, yeah, exactly.
But you're not going to have your like, giant homes and your air-conditioned spaces and your, like, on-demand meal delivery services of whatever variety you might, you know, desire
for a very
long time.
I'm not going to have it delivered by Blue Origin, because that would be cool. Anyway,
it's not out of the picture ever. And so I was curious, you know, why is Elon Musk? He's a smart guy. Why is he so fascinated with Mars and colonizing Mars? And I think what it comes down to for him is less about, oh, everything's going to be fine on Earth if we create a Mars colony, and more about we need a plan B as a civilization in case we screw up Earth so badly that we make ourselves extinct. And that's why that kind of tension between this idea of, you know, a really cool, hip Mars colony and this, like, very intense, like, this is where we're going to send our, you know, 100 last surviving humans so that we don't go extinct as a civilization is a really interesting tension. And so that was what prompted us as a team to ask that question. It's like, are there other planets that would be interesting to think about colonizing? And Venus came to mind because it has actually a much more habitable atmosphere. Not on the surface, but like a little ways up. And so there's the story that we wrote was about this basically kind of like a dirigible colony that was able to exist within the atmosphere of Venus and recycle all of the CO2 and turn it into graphene.
So I have to ask you as a final question, you use science fiction as an analysis tool and as a scenario and what if planning tool. What have you learned in 2 to 3 years of doing this that you think science fiction writers who write for entertainment purposes mm-hmm. could learn? What kind of lessons do you think they might learn from the experience you've had working with science fiction in a different way?
Well, I mean, I think one of the interesting things about Scout is that I'm learning things from science fiction authors all the time. You learn through conversation, right? So, I mean, if anything, I would say the thing that I've learned is that we should all be talking to each other more. Because all of these science fiction authors are out there who have all these really interesting new ideas, right? Malka Older is one in particular. She wrote a book, this last year that is all about rethinking what democracy and what government systems could look like on a planet where you're not divided by country. You're actually divided by what beliefs you have and what your interests are. And so you can then self-select into different political groups based on that. She's bringing this really fascinating new perspective to global democratic organization that I personally, you know, have thought about, like, what would it be like to live in a world where there were no nation states. I feel like I've learned just as much from her as she has from working with Scout. It's been a delight to work with her. But the biggest thing is just being open-minded, right? And always being open to learning new things. And science fiction does that a lot. I know I kind of didn't answer your question, but
it sounds like Basically everybody can learn from everybody else based on scenarios that, and a scenario may have an entertainment purpose, or it may have a business or organizational purpose.
The other thing, one thing I'll add is the science fiction community in the last few years has realized that all of these stories that they're telling have been acting as a kind of like joint hieroglyph for the tech communities, right? And so these classic science fiction novels, many of which were written as dystopian warnings about what the future could become, have actually started being, you know, because they exist as a blueprint for what a technological future could look like, people have been building out these dystopias in a lot of ways. And so there's been a big movement within the science fiction community itself to try and reinvent that and to actually be very deliberate about writing more positive futures. And that has taken the form of the Hieroglyph Project out of ASU that a lot of science fiction authors have been involved with. Local authors like Ramiz Nam and Brenda Cooper have both contributed to that. Scout advisor David Brin has been very involved in that. And so there's actually this really interesting movement of science among science fiction authors and strategic foresight experts to not create more dystopias, but to actually try to create literary works that give people a hopeful vision to create.
Barrett, that's great. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking with Barrett Anderson, CEO and Editor-in-Chief of Scout. Read some of Scout's analysis and fiction at scout.ai. Our producer is Claire McGrain. I'm Frank Catalano, GeekWire contributor. And you can find this special series by going to geekwire.com and searching for Popcast. That's P-O-P-Cast. And don't forget, also check out our interviews with a couple names we've mentioned here, Ramiz Nam and Greg Bear. Don't forget to subscribe to the GeekWire podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your shows. Thanks for listening to GeekWire.